So specifically, what does the historical record tell us about whether worsening conditions and worsening living standards actually spur workers and ordinary folks to rise up?
Well, of course, the referent that we all have is the Great Depression. And obviously in the 1930s, there was a crisis of huge proportions, and there was all sorts of organization that happened. But if you look at the history of the United States, that actually tends to be an anomaly. The struggles that won the eight-hour day, a lot of the key labor struggles that took place in the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century actually took place during periods of economic expansion. And those strike waves came to an end in moments of contraction, which makes sense because people have social power. During those moments of expansion, they can go on strike and not be laid off so easily. So one sees that in the early part of the 20th century. You also see it in the last kind of big wave of political struggles in this country before now, in the 1960s. That was a time, and of course we tend to remember the women's movement, the anti-war movement, the student movement, Black Power. But we should also remember that was a time of intense working class rank and file militancy and class struggle in the 60s and 70s. People had rising living standards, and that made them empowered to demand more. It kind of goes against a lot of the logic, I think, that people have on the left, that people, if they do too well, they're going to be made apolitical. But the opposite happened. I mean, it was during a time of all sorts of struggles. And what really happened was the recession of 1974, along with a lot of repression that came from the government and anti-labor actions. But the strike waves of that time actually fell off after the recession of 1974. It's interesting because left groups at the time, or quite a few of them, thought, aha, you know, now we're having this recession. This is our moment. There was one group that said the 1980s are going to make the 1930s look like a picnic. But of course, it didn't turn out that way.
Well, of course, the late 1960s saw the emergence as well of Weatherman. What did Weatherman say about the wisdom, the idea of, in this case, provoking police repression as a way to build a movement?
Right. So Weatherman, I guess we could say, one would put on the sort of outer edge of the worse the better spectrum. Those people who believed that if worse is better, then maybe the left should make things worse, create the conditions for people to become radicalized. So in the late 60s, early 70s, Weatherman believed that they could escalate chaos, that their strategy was a strategy of armed chaos, and that would create the conditions for the type of destabilization of the U.S. government and the kinds of political actions which they hoped to see. I should say that they ended up backing off from that position. They had a number of things that happened that did not turn out particularly well for them. But there was that thread through the 1970s. One can also see it with the Red Army faction in Germany. And of course, in the case of Germany, Japan, and Italy, where a bunch of these armed groups were active, there was a fairly recent memory of fascism, of real fascism that had taken place. And so they tended to believe that the governments that they were under in the 1970s were actually thinly veiled fascist states. And if they could create chaos, it would destabilize those governments to the point that they would essentially drop their shroud and the fascist face of the state would be revealed. However, their strategy did not turn out the way that they had intended. And for a lot of people on the left, they actually, the kind of escalating chaos made people pull away from movements and retreat, and quite a few back to the landers in this country did so because they were concerned about that kind of chaos.
And in your chapter on catastrophism on the left, in this new book, Catastrophism, you also point to the fact that chaotic moments also offer opportunities to the right, to reactionary elements.
Indeed. I mean, I think that's a crucial thing to remember. Even taking the Great Depression again, that reference point for so many people, lynchings were on the rise during the Great Depression, whereas in the previous decade of expansion in the 20s, they had fallen. it's very clear looking around us now during this crisis, looking at Europe, that the kind of chaos produced by an economic crisis often really gives a boost to the right, because it's very easy for the right to scapegoat other people. And during crises, people often don't do what we on the left would hope that they do. They don't necessarily turn to sort of mass solidarity and collective action. They often try and cope individually, sometimes try and exclude other people from the workforce based on their gender or their race, or migrate. And these are individual responses rather than collective responses, and the right tends to do very well from moments like that. It is, of course, possible for people to organize themselves during times of crisis or times of chaos, but there's nothing predetermined about how those will come out, and very, very often they come out well for the right.
Are you arguing that radicals should hope capitalist crises do not occur?
I think that's a pointless hope. Capitalism is about crisis. That is an essential part of it. During the 90s, there was that sort of brief moment of total delusion where people thought they had gotten away from crises, that, you know, the stock market could go up and up and up, and crises were a thing of the past. Clearly, crises are essential to the capitalist system. And as long as we have capitalism, we'll have crises. I think the lesson that we need to learn instead is, whoever goes into the crisis with more strength, with more organization, with more groundwork laid, tends to do better during a crisis. So really, if there's any sort of practical implication for the left, it's that people should think about taking organization very seriously.
And you use the term in your chapter in this book, despondent politics. Can you explain that and tell us to what degree it might bind together some of the versions of catastrophism you've been talking about?
Catastrophism doesn't come out of a historical vacuum. I mean, as I mentioned, actually, it's been with the left for the past century at least. But I would argue that the last 40 years, there has been a particular despondency about the possibility to change society in any fundamental way, and hence people have tended to fall back into a kind of catastrophic view. If we don't have the collective action, the collective strength to change society, then let's just hope that something else will do it for us. Peak oil, a financial crisis. One could come up with a number of different scenarios, but these are essentially seen as external things that will create an opportunity that doesn't exist up into them. Now, there are many reasons why that kind of political despair has been operative, including, you know, the genuine failure of mass movements in the 70s. And one could spend a lot of time talking about those reasons. But just putting them to the side, I think that although the degree of despair that people have had about political change is understandable, we need to very strongly resist it, because it lends itself to very problematic politics. On the one hand, when the left indulges in scaremongering or fear, it can be very paralyzing to most people. People don't want to touch it. On the other hand, it can also lend itself to adventuristic actions by a small vanguard group, that if you really feel like the world can't change unless there is some kind of catastrophic rupture, if you feel like even in fact you need to bring it on, that's the kind of thing that lends itself to having a small cadre of people try and take action in isolation. And there are serious problems that always arise out of that kind of politics. So while on the one hand, I think it's commendable if people want to see the world changed, and I think there is something within catastrophism which is, you know, genuinely something we can identify with, which is, you know, people want to see some fundamental change to society. And I think that's absolutely legitimate and fair. And I think that's actually possible. But catastrophism as a shortcut is not the way to get there.
Sasha Lilly's new book is Catastrophism. She has co-authored it with David McNally, Eddie Ewan, and James Davis. We have a link to the book on againstthegrain.org. Sasha, thanks so much for joining me.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, CS.
And to return to a point made by Sasha Lilly early on in that discussion, not to deny the importance of ecological factors, which we must take seriously, The show largely ignores them because it's focused on what I think are the easiest angles to change, the importance, the centrality of this hierarchical money system in organizing human activity. That one is up to us, mankind. I'm not going to draw a distinction between the rich and powerful and the powerless, because on one level, we all have about the same number of arms and legs that work. And yes, some of us have hired servants, some of us have hierarchical organizations which we can draw on. That, however, is in the current status quo. And whatever anybody shouts about sustainability, it seems to me that no, this system is not sustainable. And if, as dire warnings of ecologists tell us, we see mass starvation, billions more hungry people, those people will be in a position of having nothing to lose. Now, I don't want to go down the negative, it'll collapse under its own weight angle, but to look instead at the positive, well, what can we do? Sasha Lilly talked about the importance of organization and communication. Now, I think since the World Wide Web in particular, there's been an intense communication, people explaining, clarifying, discovering that the hierarchical organizations of the world are largely run by the sort of people you wouldn't put in charge of anything if you knew their deep history, and people discovering the significance of seemingly small changes, like, for example, guerrilla gardening of food near where they live. That's something on a small scale, seems to be an insignificant change, but if it's something that has a global appeal, something that you can do, tell other people, these days, of course, global communication can very quickly make that a worldwide movement. Where was the power, where was the money behind the transition movement, which has been a factor in changing the lives of many people? Of course, there's not a lot of money there. That was the power of a good idea and some good people promoting it. So if, as I am constantly reminding my students, we have some information technology which puts huge resources at our fingertips in terms of information, huge potential, why do people fail to use this? Why do people allow their imagination to be truncated? And in particular, why do people assume that this system, which they've seen all their lives up to now, must necessarily continue forever? Well, let's return to David Graeber. We're going to hear a 5-minute section from Chapter 11 on the machinery to perpetuate hopelessness.
We live now at a genuinely peculiar historical juncture. The credit crisis has provided us with a vivid illustration of the principle set out in the last chapter, that capitalism cannot really operate in a world where people believe it will be around forever. For most of the last several centuries, most people assumed that credit could not be generated infinitely because they assumed that the economic system itself was unlikely to endure forever. The future was likely to be fundamentally different. Yet somehow, the anticipated revolutions never happened. The basic structures of financial capitalism largely remained in place. It's only now, at the very moment when it's becoming increasingly clear that current arrangements are not viable, that we've suddenly hit the wall in terms of our collective imagination. There is very good reason to believe that in a generation or so, capitalism itself will no longer exist. Most obviously, as ecologists keep reminding us, because it's impossible to maintain an engine of perpetual growth forever on a finite planet. And the current form of capitalism doesn't seem to be capable of generating the kind of vast technological breakthroughs and mobilizations that would be required for us to start finding and colonizing other planets. Yet faced with the prospect of capitalism actually ending, the most common reaction, even from those who call themselves progressives, is simply fear. We cling to what exists because we can no longer imagine an alternative that wouldn't be even worse. How did we get here? My own suspicion is that we're looking at the final effects of the militarization of American capitalism itself. In fact, it could well be said that the last 30 years have seen the construction of a vast bureaucratic apparatus for the creation and maintenance of hopelessness, a giant machine designed first and foremost to destroy any sense of possible alternative futures. At its root is a veritable obsession on the part of the rulers of the world, in response to the upheavals of the 60s and 70s, with ensuring that social movements cannot be seen to grow, flourish, or propose alternatives, that those who challenge existing power arrangements can never, under any circumstances, be perceived to win. To do so requires creating a vast apparatus of armies, prisons, police, various forms of private security firms, and police and military intelligence apparatus, and propaganda engines of every conceivable variety, most of which do not attack alternatives directly, so much as create a pervasive climate of fear, jingoistic conformity, and simple despair that renders any thought of changing the world seem an idle fantasy. Maintaining this apparatus seems even more important to exponents of the free market, even than maintaining any sort of viable market economy. How else can one explain what happened in the former Soviet Union? One would ordinarily have imagined that the end of the Cold War would have led to the dismantling of the army and the KGB and the rebuilding of factories. But in fact, what happened was precisely the other way round. This is just an extreme example of what has been happening everywhere. Economically, the apparatus is pure deadweight. All the guns, surveillance cameras, and propaganda engines are extraordinarily expensive and really produce nothing. And no doubt, it's yet another element dragging the entire capitalist system down, along with producing the illusion of an endless capitalist future that laid the groundwork for the endless bubbles to begin with. Finance capital became the buying and selling of chunks of that future, and economic freedom, for most of us, was reduced to the right to buy and sell a small piece of one's permanent subordination. In other words, there seems to have been a profound contradiction between the political imperative of establishing capitalism as the only possible way to manage anything and capitalism's own unacknowledged need to limit its future horizons lest speculation, predictably, go haywire. Once it did, and the whole machine imploded, we were left in a strange situation of not being able to even imagine any other way that things might be arranged. About the only thing we can imagine is catastrophe.
Well, in a sense, it's inevitable that we're having difficulty to imagine the future, if the future is going to be very different from our past experience. But there's a few obvious points we can talk about. Yes, we're going to want to eat food. How are we going to get food? If we have a society dominated by agribusiness, where food is purveyed to us by third parties who do so motivated by economic gain, then the idea of that economic system grinding to a halt naturally raises fears that perhaps that food isn't going to arrive. And that one point, provision of food, seems to me to be at the heart of a lot of people's fears of catastrophe. You may have rioting gangs of people in the streets. Well, if you can provide for yourself in terms of food, you don't need to go in the streets. What is the catastrophe? Lack of good films on the television? Lack of electricity? There's nothing more potent than lack of food. I'm not expecting rents and so on to be collected. So that, I think, is the heart of people's fears of catastrophe. Now, John Taylor Gatto has chronicled how America was turned from a nation of self-sufficient farmers into a nation of workers in offices, hierarchies. And thanks to Lynn Gerry for reading that book on air, we're now going to hear a chapter from that book which she missed out, which makes the point that people's thinking has been deliberately limited by the powers that be on the subject of alternative systems and ways of living.
School as we know it was the creation of four great coal powers whose ingenious employment of the coal-powered steam engine shrank distance and crippled local integrity and the credibility of local elites. But the United States produced almost as much coal as the other three school-bound nations put together, as you can see from the figures for coal production in 1905. Number 1, US, 351 million tons. UK, 236 million tons. Germany, 121 million, France, 35 million. Prior to the advent of coal-based economics, mass society was a phenomenon of the Orient, spoken of with contempt in the West. Even as late as 1941, I remember a barrage of adult discourse from press, screen, radio, and from conversations of elders, that Japan and China had no respect for human life, by which I presume they meant individual human life. Banzai was supposed to be the cry of fanatical Japanese infantrymen eager to die for the emperor, but Western fighting men, in the words of H.G. Wells' wife, were, quote, thinking bayonets, unquote. For that reason, Germany was much more feared than Japan in World War II. With the advent of coal and steam engines, modern civilization and modern schooling came about. One of the great original arguments for mass schooling was that it would tame and train children uprooted from families broken by mining and factory work in sophisticated spots like Unitarian Boston and Quaker Anglican Philadelphia. School was sold to the upper classes as a tool to keep children from rooting themselves in the culture of their own industrially debased parents. The full impact of coal-massified societies on human consciousness is caught inadvertently in Caltech nuclear scientist Harrison Brown's The Challenge of Men's Future, a 1954 book pronounced, quote, great, unquote, by fellow Nobel Prize-winning geneticist Hermann Müller. Brown examines carefully the probability that the human carrying capacity of the planet is between 50 and 200 billion people, before summarizing the reasons that this fact is best kept secret, quote, if humanity had its way, it would not rest content until the earth is completely covered, and to a considerable depth, with a writhing mass of human beings, much as a dead cow is covered with a pulsating mass of maggots, unquote. Brown's metaphors reveal something of the attitude that raised schooling in the first place on the industrial base of coal, steam, and steel. Among other things, the new institution would be an instrument to prevent mass humanity from having its way. This essay, characteristic of many such syntheses issuing from foundation and corporate-sponsored university figures of reputation throughout the century, as well as from public intellectuals like H.G. Wells, was written on the island of Jamaica, which to Brown appears to be a tropical paradise, but his scientific eye sees it as actually the world in miniature, where the struggle for survival goes on amidst ugliness, starvation, and misery. In this deceptive utopia, the comfortable and secure 20% who live in a machine civilization made possible by coal and oil are actually in a very precarious position, threatened by the rapid multiplication of the starving. Such paranoia runs like a backbone through Western history, from Malthus to Carl Sagan. Only the United States can stop the threat of overbreeding, says Nobel laureate Brown. Quote, the destiny of humanity depends on our decisions and upon our actions. Unquote. And what price should we pay for safety? Nothing less than, quote, world authority with jurisdiction over population, unquote. The penalty for previous overproduction of the unfit had become by 1954 simply this, that, quote, thoughts and actions must be ever more strongly limited, unquote. Brown continued, we must create a society, quote, where social organization is all-pervasive, complex, and inflexible, and where the state completely dominates the individual, unquote. What is inflexible social organization but a class system? Remember your own school? Did a class system exist there? I can see you through my typewriter keys. You're nodding.
If you listen carefully, you'll have heard the carrying capacity of the earth discussed there as possibly between 50 and 200 billion people, with a B, That's a point of view we don't often hear on the commercially controlled media. Not that we hear the numbers discussed at all. Often it's very much in more general, metaphorical terms. But we have no time to look into that this show. We continue exploring the potency of catastrophism. Why, if humanity has been making progress, do people find it so easy to imagine that disaster is just around the corner? While we continue with the section from an audiobook, this is Disciplined Minds, which we've already published on the show, and the whole work is a masterpiece, but I've selected this section as an explanation to why professional people, the people that our culture encourages us to respect and value for their knowledge, wisdom, why they are particularly likely to support the status quo and to leave unasked questions about the assumptions which underpin the hierarchical roles that society assigns for them.
Going on to the next subsection of Chapter 11, titled Freudian Slips. There are mathematical methods for determining how well a college admissions examination does its job of predicting success in college. One can compare test scores and college grades, for example, but there is no formula for writing the examination that will do the best job. The most that question writers can do is maintain a mental image of a student who does well in college and dream up questions that will be more difficult for other students than for this student. The more accurate the writer's mental image of the kind of student that their clients, the colleges, want, the better they will do at writing questions that favor such students. The goal of today's liberal admissions or qualifying examination is to offer all students, rich and poor, majority and minority, male and female, an equal opportunity to serve the system. But the question writer's image of the student set for success in college is probably that of a middle-class white male, not because the question writer is prejudiced, but because such a student is the most likely to succeed. It is inevitable that the question writers working with this mental image will from time to time take a cheap shot and write a question whose superficial content gives an unnecessary advantage to middle-class white or male students. However, the resulting scattered gratuitous biases against poor, minority, and female students cannot account for the significantly lower scores of these students on the test as a whole. It is the systemic bias in favor of those best prepared to serve the status quo that accounts for the scores. If the cheap shots are important, it is because they are Freudian slips by question writers, and like such slips in general, are embarrassing because they are revealing. In this case, revealing of the tester's mental image of the typical student that colleges seek. The Educational Testing Service inadvertently drew my attention to one of their Freudian slips, one showing that they consciously adjust which groups of people their tests favor. They must make such adjustments, of course, to meet the changing recruitment priorities of their clients, the colleges. The example illustrates the historic change from the old recruitment regime, which, among its other biases, simply favored men, to the present regime, which favors anyone with male-gendered values. When I phoned the giant gatekeeping organization to see what they would tell me about their test bias, they put me in touch with one of their principal measurement specialists, Michael J. Zeike. Yes, Zeike, said ETS, often finds bias in proposed test items and does its best to root it out. The example he chose to give me was that women get lower scores than men on questions about war and on questions about geometry. A few days after I spoke with Zeike, a couple of ETS booklets he had promised to send arrived in the mail. As I read about the testing behemoth's sensitivity to women, I was startled to come across this, quote, where a question in a mathematics test might once have mentioned Mary Smith's calculations for roasting a turkey, a similar question today might mention her calculations for establishing missile trajectories, close quote. Missile trajectories, a masterful combination of war and geometry. This choice of context, surely made unknowingly, blurts out the tester's male-gendered view of expanded opportunity for women, as suggested by the question's original formulation in terms of turkey roasting, which put the woman in a stereotypical kitchen role. Question writers of the old regime favored men. As suggested by the question's new context, today's question writers favor anyone who has a male-gendered orientation and who is therefore advantageously positioned to succeed in college today. The actions of the test makers show that they understood thoroughly the different kinds of bias and different levels of content discussed here. They know full well that the visible biases, which in the past proved very costly in terms of public relations and threatened the entire testing enterprise, are in fact unnecessary and can be dropped. Or better yet, freely manipulated to make the test appear to favor the disadvantaged without affecting scores. The resulting questions that appear to favor working people, minorities, and women are most easily answered by middle-class white males because these questions have a more fundamental bias, a bias towards those with the attitude and values that the system seeks. By reversing the unnecessary biases in the superficial content of the tests, liberal psychometricians have done little more than put an egalitarian face on an instrument of pro-system bias. They've worked hard to make this superficial change, but they have worked even harder to prevent examination reform from going beyond it. Professional question writers certainly know which social groups are most likely to do well on the tests that they help construct, but that is not what makes them good question writers. They are good at their job of coming up with just the right questions because they have an intuitive feeling for the values, attitude, outlook, and approach that the tests favor. They have internalized the spirit of the tests. Because they have made the spirit of the tests their own, they are likely on occasion to gild the lily and come up with questions whose superficial content carries the very same bias that the test as a whole carries. A look at some examples is informative and entertaining, but one must remember not to overestimate the importance of biases that are visible in the superficial content of test questions. Apparently, whoever wrote the following GRE analytical ability questions understands, perhaps subconsciously, that one characteristic of students who are promising from the system's point of view is a willingness and ability to comply with bureaucracies rather than fight them. As with all the examples that I present, to understand the argument fully, the reader should actually write down answers before proceeding. Okay, well, this is a radio program, and you're not going to be able to do that. But I'm going to give you a brief sense of this question, of the flavor of it. This is a series of questions, such as, to apply to college, a student must see the school counselor, obtain a transcript at the transcript office, and obtain a recommendation from teacher A or teacher B. A student must see the counselor before obtaining a transcript. The counselor is available only Friday mornings and Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday afternoons. The transcript office is open only Tuesday and Wednesday mornings, Thursday afternoons, and Friday mornings. Teacher A is available only Monday and Wednesday mornings. Teacher B is available only Monday afternoons and Friday mornings. Maria, a student, has already seen the counselor and does not care from which teacher she obtains her recommendation. Which of the following is a complete and accurate list of days when she could possibly complete the application process in one day? and it goes on asking for different permutations on that. Another series of questions. You cannot enter unless you have a red ticket. If you present a blue form signed by the director, you will receive a red ticket. The director will sign and give you a blue form only if you surrender your yellow pass to him. If you have a green slip, you can exchange it for a yellow pass, but you can do so only if you have a blue form signed by the director, etc. And Schmidt continues, anyone attempting to impose an admission system like the one above, say at a rock concert, would discover very quickly that different individuals respond in different ways to systems of bureaucratic control. Yes, some people would spend their time focused on the rules, analyzing and reanalyzing them, trying to figure out what they are supposed to do. Others, however, would simply present whatever documents they have and demand to be let in. Yet others would take a glance at the rules and storm the gate. An individual's tendency to submit to bureaucratic control or to fight it, or to do some of each, reflects the individual's attitude about how to deal with power, a political attitude. To many of us, a decision to storm the gate would show more analytical ability than would a decision to submit to an oppressive level of bureaucratic control. But the test works to give lower analytical ability scores, not higher scores, to those who would resist. Those whose political orientation leads them to comply with schemes for bureaucratic control feel at home working within systems of rules like the ones in the above questions, and typically have a lifetime of experience with such an approach to draw upon in answering this type of question. On the other hand, those whose political orientation would lead them to choose resistance as the answer to the broad problem of what to do are not likely to do their best work when restricted to the narrow problem of how to do what you are supposed to do. Yet this is the problem that serves as the official measure of analytical ability. When all else is equal, then, the test will give higher analytical ability scores to individuals whose tendency is to comply than to individuals whose tendency is to resist. The test as a whole tilts towards those who feel comfortable working within arbitrary rules, who are used to working out technical details within a dictated framework, who make their way in the world through careful attention to the rules. These individuals do not require motivation from or even knowledge of the social origin of their assigned problems. As soon as the rules are revealed, they jump right into the detail work without the mental reservations that disturb and distract others. The test favors these cooperative objects of bureaucratic control. And, as the examples above indicate, sometimes does so blatantly. We have seen that what appears to be cultural biases in selection examinations are actually political biases at root. The tests serve the interests of employers and help reproduce the present social structure by favoring individuals who are most likely to fit in well in hierarchical organizations. The test's success at doing this is cause for their abolition. Without the benefit of test scores, an educational institution's ranking of applicants would be less of a ranking by attitudes and values, and would therefore result in a more politically diverse student body. Ultimately, employers would have to contend with, and make concessions to, a segment of the workforce at the higher educational levels that is more politically diverse, and therefore less politically subordinate.
And thanks to Jeff Schmidt for writing that book, and Lynn Goey for reading it. Jeff Schmidt, of course, was fired soon after that book was published, only to be later reinstated with undisclosed damages following a long legal battle. I think it's a brave and insightful man who can pen a book like that. And speaking personally, I'm convinced that he's inspired many more followers to do the same, to look upon their professional qualifications not as great measures of hard work and determination, but to see them in a broader social context. Now, to return to the topic of catastrophe and fear, a quick music break, and a reminder that, as I was growing up, with scarcely a word about ecological collapse, never mind financial collapse, enormous amounts of resources had nevertheless been invested by the so-called most developed governments of the world to ensure that the threat of apocalypse was nevertheless a real and credible one.
I have seen it estimated, somewhere between death and birth, there are now 3,000 million people living on this earth. And the stockpiled mass destruction of the nuclear powers that be equals for each man or woman 20 tons of TNT. Every man of every nation, 20 tons of TNT, shall receive this allocation, 20 tons of TNT. Texan, Bantu, Slav or Maori, Argentine or Singali, every maiden brings this dowry, 20 tons of TNT. Not for 30 silver shilling, 20 tons of TNT, 20,000 pounds a killing, 20 tons of TNT. 20 hundred years of teaching, give to each his legacy, Plato, Buddha, Christ or Lenin, 20 tons of TNT. Father, mother, son and daughter, give us land and seed and water. Children have no need of sharing at each new nativity, come the ghostly magi bearing 20 tons of TNT. Ends the tale that has no sequel, 20 tons of TNT. Now in death are all made equal, 20 tons of TNT. Teach me how to love my neighbor, do to him as he to me, share the fruits of all our labor. 20 tons of TNT.
And that was, of course, Flanders and Swan with 20 tons of TNT. Nuclear weapons and nuclear power being just the most visible manifestation of humanity's instinct to self-destruct, and I'd love to believe that those were the bad old days, now past, and no one is researching race-specific bioweapons or means of targeting particular individuals with particular DNA. Sadly, however, I find the facts force me to think otherwise. The veil of national security is still being used to cloak all manner of goings-on. Who knows? Not me. This idea that one nation must keep things secret because of the need to compete with other nations. I think such a notion is, on a deep level, self-destructive of humanity, just as I think it's self-destructive to divide ourselves from the natural world, or self-destructive to think that this fiction money, which seems so important to people, should somehow be given priority over the natural world. So I am anticipating a collapse in confidence in money. That need not be a catastrophe in its negative sense, and apart from abolition of rent, another positive consequence might be ceasing in research into new technologies of destruction. How credible are the claims made by various people in the US administration that it's essential to spend the majority of their money funding the so-called Defense Department? Is there an external threat looming over the USA, or is the increasing priority given to military and control technologies the last gasp of a delegitimized elite seeking to maintain a stranglehold over people's imaginations. We return to Chapter 11 of David Graeber for some insights on the connection between money and the military, and the need for capitalism to find some kind of external threat.
If there's something to be learned here, and as I say, I think there is, it is that there may be a deeper, more profound relation between gambling and apocalypse. Capitalism is a system that enshrines the gambler as an essential part of its operation, in a way that no other ever has. Yet, at the same time, capitalism seems to be uniquely incapable of conceiving of its own eternity. Could these two facts be linked? I should be more precise here. It's not entirely true that capitalism is incapable of conceiving of its own eternity. On the one hand, its exponents do feel obliged to present it as eternal, because they insist that it is the only possible viable economic system. One that, as they still sometimes like to say, has existed for 5,000 years and will exist for 5,000 more. On the other hand, it does seem that the moment a significant portion of the population begins to actually believe this, and particularly starts treating credit institutions as if they really will be around forever, everything goes haywire. Note here how it was the most sober, cautious, responsible capitalist regimes, the 17th century Dutch Republic, the 18th century British Commonwealth, the ones most careful about managing their public debt, that saw the most bizarre explosions of speculative frenzy, the tulip manias and South Sea bubbles. Much of this seems to turn on the nature of national deficits and credit money. The national debt is, as politicians have complained practically since these things first appeared, money borrowed from future generations. Still, the effects have always been strangely double-edged. On the one hand, deficit financing is a way of putting even more military power in the hands of princes, generals, and politicians. On the other, it suggests that our government owes something to those it governs. Insofar as our money is ultimately an extension of the public debt, then whenever we buy a newspaper or a cup of coffee, or even place a bet on a horse, we're trading in promises, representations of something that the government will give us at some time in the future, even if we don't know exactly what it is. Immanuel Wallerstein likes to point out that the French Revolution introduced several profoundly new ideas in politics, ideas which, 50 years before the Revolution, the vast majority of educated Europeans would have written off as crazy, but which, 50 years afterward, just about anyone felt they had to at least pretend they thought were true. The first is that social change is inevitable and desirable, that the natural direction of history is for civilization to gradually improve. The second is that the appropriate agent to manage such change is the government. The third is that the government gains its legitimacy from an entity called the people. It's easy to see how the very idea of a national debt, a promise of continual future improvement, at the very least 5% annual improvement, made by the government to the people, might itself have played a role in inspiring such a revolutionary new perspective. Yet, at the same time, when one looks at what men like Mirabeau, Voltaire, Diderot, Sieyès, the philosophers who first proposed the notion of what we now call civilization, were actually arguing about in the years immediately leading up to the revolution, it was even more about the danger of apocalyptic catastrophe, of the prospect of civilization as they knew it being destroyed by default and economic collapse. Part of the problem was the obvious one. The national debt is, first, born of war. Second, it's not owed to all the people equally, but above all to capitalists, and in France at that time, capitalist meant specifically those who hold pieces of the national debt. The more democratically inclined felt that the entire situation was opprobrious.
The modern theory of the perpetuation of debt, Thomas Jefferson wrote around this same time, has drenched the earth with blood and crushed its inhabitants under burdens ever accumulating.
Most Enlightenment thinkers feared that it promised even worse. Intrinsic to the new modern notion of impersonal debt, after all, was the possibility of bankruptcy. Bankruptcy at that time was indeed something of a personal apocalypse. It meant prison, the dissolution of one's estate. For the least fortunate, it meant torture, starvation, and death. What national bankruptcy would mean at that point in history, nobody knew. There were simply no precedents. Yet, as nations fought greater and bloodier wars, and their debts escalated geometrically, default began to appear unavoidable. Abbé Sieyès first put forward his great scheme for representative government, for instance, primarily as a way of reforming the national finances to fend off the inevitable catastrophe. And when it happened, what would it look like? Would the money become worthless? Would military regimes seize power? Regimes across Europe be likewise forced to default and fall like dominoes, plunging the continent into endless barbarism, darkness, and war? Many were already anticipating the prospect of the terror long before the revolution itself. It's a strange story, because we're used to thinking of the Enlightenment as the dawn of a unique phase of human optimism, born on assumptions that make the advance of science and human knowledge would inevitably make life wiser, safer, and better for everyone. A naive faith said to have peaked in the Fabian socialism of the 1890s, only to be annihilated in the trenches of World War I. In fact, even the Victorians were haunted by the dangers of degeneration and decline. Most of all, Victorians shared the near universal assumption that capitalism itself would not be around forever. Insurrection seemed imminent. Many Victorian capitalists operated under the sincere belief that they might, at any moment, find themselves hanging from trees. In Chicago, for instance, a friend once took me on a drive down a beautiful old street, full of mansions from the 1870s. The reason he explained that it looked like that was that most of Chicago's rich industrialists of the time were so convinced that the revolution was imminent that they collectively relocated along the road that led to the nearest military base. Almost none of the great theories of capitalism from anywhere on the political spectrum, from Marx to Weber, to Schumpeter to von Mises, felt that capitalism was likely to be around for more than another generation or two at most. And one could go further. The moment that the fear of imminent social revolution no longer seemed plausible, by the end of World War II, we were immediately presented with the spectre of nuclear holocaust. Then, when that no longer seemed plausible, we discovered global warming. This is not to say that these threats were not and are not real. Yet, it does seem strange that capitalism feels the constant need to imagine, or to actually manufacture, the means of its own imminent extinction.
Mr. Economist, don't preach to me about trickle-down theory. It's a fallacy, propagated callously. So we believe the deceit and keep imagination living in poverty. The national lottery is a tax on stupidity. Prosperity doesn't trickle down to most folks, because the rising tide lifts the biggest boats, and the sea's getting kind of rocky lately. Still, the crest don't exist without the wave underneath it. One, own the air that the rest of us breathe in. Tribute survived from colonial days. Masters demand tax from ungrateful slaves. Now it's a PR game. Still works the same cash rules with the iron fist in the background. The mob knows how to lay a smack down to crush disobedience from anyone in town. And sending the goons if anyone gets out of line. That's how protection rackets work since the dawn of time. Now the state takes the same old line. Governments are just well-armed gangsters with delusions of grandeur, with law on their side as they're kicking in front doors to settle scores. Wherever natives get restless and rise up to threaten vital business interests, the death toll rises from the latest war. Yeah, we could argue all night about what it's really for. Just ask any private in the army. The only thing that trickles down is everyday brutality.
And you're listening to a slightly expurgated version of Clayton Blizzard's Don't Let Money Change You.
I bring righteous indignation to bling bling quits. Don't need diamonds to make you shake your hips. Money don't exist. It's just figures in columns, as elusive as the cash in my bank manager's wallet. It's so common to be poor in a rich country. A $1 trillion economy is comfortable with your poverty. The market understands its wish is your command. That's called the law of supply and demand. Whenever there is profit, there is loss. Like when trees are still a cost. Wherever there is privilege and luxury, there's abject poverty coexisting peacefully, but not for long. Don't want to live at the periphery of someone else's nightmare. I'm not racing for wealth and property. Just trying to live life on that line between poverty and greed. The bad news is we're not free, we're cheap. Bought off with dreams of a Beamer or a Jeep. At the head table, begging for scraps. Praying that they'll lapse and give you half a chance. And that's begging your master to set you free. As if benevolence tyranny would make poverty history. Let's ask the superstar singers. Thank God we got them to save us, or we'd really be f***ed. GNP is up, so how come I'm not richer? I don't understand economics, so what can you say? Most of us got nothing for a rainy day. Your pension is not safe with the stock market. I want my contribution back, but they spent it. Don't understand economics, but I understand this. The free market is free to those who can afford it, and very expensive to those that can't. Very, 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 very expensive. But you'll know me, I just put my lack of money where my mouth is. So if you want to come and take a ride with me, I really hope you got the money for a taxi. Oh, why do I live this way? Hey, that'll be the lack of money. Never drank Cristal or been to China Whites, but I might cane a cheap bottle of vodka on a Friday night. If anyone would like to join me, see you on College Green. That's in the hilly city in the divided kingdom. A system of feudalism means we live in serfdom. Kings got closed circuit vision to survey the fiefdom. Medieval economics, but surveillance is modern. Land hasn't been common since the Enclosures Act of 1750. The basis for a privileged economy based on the sanctity of private property. Here's good news for the many that are near the knock of opportunity. We can't eat money, so it will end the ignorant arrogance of the North Atlantic. Fashionable antics left in our wake. And if cod stocks are low, let them eat hake.
This show and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from our archive at unwelcomeguests.net/archive.
So, Mr. Economist, don't preach to me. I got personal debt right up to the knees for all the things I had to buy, like education and beliefs and aspirational magazines. Now I'm counting down the days till it's paid or I die. Let's see what comes first. There's nobody in the sky to pay for the hearse. We're not free, we're cheap. Bought off with the sedative to put us to sleep. Why not just put on a grass skirt and have done with it? If you're a native, you want money, then dance for it. Notwithstanding the standard neoliberal rhetoric, the only thing that trickles down this far is bullshit. Nations go cap in hand to the World Bank, like me at my local branch, annoying the staff, giving it, mate, you're having a laugh, I'll pay you back, I just need one more extension on my overdraft. We wear debt round our necks like a millstone, the debt of forefathers paid by daughters and sons who dream of breaking with tradition and being the first sane generation to make a free space for living. These fantasies are beautiful, that's why we cling to them. Money can buy license, but it can't buy freedom. Do you believe them? Millionaire rappers who came just to prove you can be rich and still be a slave. Cause who pays the piper calls the tune? Who pays the piper calls the tune? There's a lot of mental slaves in recording rooms. Cause who pays the piper calls the tune? And I hate work, so everyone thinks I'm lazy, but I'm thoughtful and patient. I think constantly, so time's never wasted. In case you didn't know it, I'm not rich, but I've never known real hardship, never had much money, but I'm one of the lucky ones. In the natal lottery, born unburdened by sour defeat, change doesn't trickle down to us, it rises up like dust, so stamp your feet. Change doesn't trickle down to us, it rises up like dust, so stamp your feet. Change doesn't trickle down to us, it rises up like dust, so stamp your feet. Change doesn't trickle down to us, it rises up like dust, so everybody in the house stamp your feet, yo.
Our theme tune, The Unwelcome Guest, is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie.
Don't let money change ya, da 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 dee da, da 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 dee da, da 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 dee da. Don't let money change
you. I hope this show has decreased your fear of the future and instead encourage you to make concrete plans for how you can feed yourself and those close to you, irrespective of catastrophes, zombies, social collapse, and the so-called fiscal cliff.
Don't let money change.